But I want to follow the career of one person. I was reading in the book about a Louise that was one of the wildest flappers of this group. And in fact, when she turned down one of the Provincetown players to marry someone else, he committed suicide, and that created one of the great scandals of that time. And I was imagining Louise facilely, as people do when they read a book about someone. And suddenly it named the man that she married, Verez, Edgar Verez. And that was Louise Verez. And my brain almost turned entirely around, because that was the woman I had known in the 50s as that beautiful, graceful, strong, powerful, lovely, warm, elderly lady who invited us into the home of Verez. By us, I mean myself and my composer friend Jim Tenney, and into his studio, where we were not permitted to smoke. And it was Louise who endeared us forever in the tension of meeting the great composer Verez and listening to all his ideas, who leaned over and whispered to us while he was searching out a manuscript, "You know, you can go into the bathroom, and if you open the window about an inch, you can smoke and blow your smoke out the window, and Edgar will never know." It was also Louise who recognized that we weren't eating very well and who managed to provide for us sometimes as many as three meals, called snacks, in an afternoon. This sweet, wonderful person, who was, like so many others, someone who carried sparks from the Provincetown Playhouse early productions and O'Neill's unacknowledged, but absolutely should be clear to us now, theater of the mind. Verez was entirely different than Louise. He was different than anyone I met. In fact, all different parts of his body were different, because he dressed in a multitude of plaids, plaid shirt, plaid tie with diagonals, a plaid coat of totally different color, plaid pants. He'd have worn plaid shoes, I'm sure, if they made them. And he was a walking example of the kind of music that he made. Verez, after marrying Louise, did not just stay in the village. He stayed into the late 30s, as I understand it, until he had a nervous breakdown. A breakdown that was caused by the increasing neglect of music, the refusal to accept even what was at that time his rather more standard orchestral works. And pressures, all these pressures converging in his mid-age crisis, I suppose. And after all that initial excitement of the 20s, the society was burning down. Unless you were very, very social and could pick up on the social dilemmas of the times, as, say, Orson Welles did with his Mercury Theater. So anyway, for whatever all reasons, Verez cracked up and got into that position very much like the American composer Charles Ives had before him, and where he could not stand to hear any noise whatsoever. He'd begin to tremble. And Louise Verez, who was very good at translating, supported both of them across a 10-year period by translating the novels of Simenon. She also later did some beautiful translations of, for instance, Rimbaud. But during this period, it was just a bread-and-butter translating that would permit her to take him to Death Valley, which is where they lived, across from the late 30s to the mid to late 40s. And he recovered himself and began to compose, and it's across that period that he orchestrated and then began making, collecting these sounds to be interpolated within the piece. And that's why many people call him the father of electronic music. I mean, he was imagining electronic music back in the 20s and was working on it in the 30s and, of course, in Death Valley in the 40s, when there wasn't really anything but wire recorders and, of course, records that could be cut, but no way to control the sounds in the way in which he wanted to. He was anticipating the tape recorder. So that by the time I met him in the early 50s, he was still relying on these very early tapes. He had in 1952, I believe, the first performance of Deserts in Paris, France, and he was, of course, from France. Then came back and lived out his life in the village. I also want to be sure to include this story. What finally killed him was he went into a hospital for a hemorrhoid operation that he didn't even need, but would have made him more comfortable, and there was some problem with anesthesia, and he died on the operating table. But when I knew both him and Louise, they were among the most vibrant. He was at the height of launching, really, the whole involvement with electronic music in this country and abroad. He was concerned with where even sounds would mix in the very air. He was coming out of a tradition that I want to give you some example of, too. But mainly I want to stress that from the beginning, long before he became the father of electronic music, his drive was similar to O'Neill's and many others in the sense of needing to express something of the inner mind, the inner thought process at work, for which the old forms of music would not do. The filmmaker Ingmar Bergman said that, quote, "Art lost its basic creative drive the moment it was separated from worship. In former days, the artist remained unknown, and his work was to the glory of God." I would make the claim that it's all the same pursuit, but that the cathedral has become the mind, not in the sense of egocentric or a giant monument, which it also unfortunately is too often thought of, but as an endless way through to the universe and to forces and patterns that we don't understand. Just so